Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, back once again. Renegade Master, D4 damage with ill behaviour. I'm old. Also, I don't actually think they're the words, but you get what I mean. How you doing? Dan Lasak here. That's me. That's my voice. Episode 14 of Falling Forward with Dan Lasak. Yes, I said my name twice. How you doing? I've quit smoking, so I hate you all, passionately. Really, you know, I want to kill people and hope that all joy in the world dies. So there's that. I did the thing. I'm actually using one of those vap sticks. It's like a USB stick that makes smoke happen, which seems to be helping. So if you're looking to quit, you know, you can do it. Because I've been smoking for 20 years and I've gone a good couple of weeks now. So I think you can do it too. There you go, there's the positivity for the episode done. You know, I've given you a good hearty message to live your life by. So who's this week's guest? This week's guest is the most different of all of our guests so far, I think, personally. She's a toy maker, puppet maker, model maker, a lot of maker in there, but also puppet fixer-upper. Her name's Kerry Dyer, and you can find her at kerrymakesthings.com. Hang on, let me just double check that. Hang on, I'm scrolling through my phone. Don't worry. Yeah, kerrymakesthings.com. Edit. I missed something. Kerry's got some new stuff on her shop as well. That website link I just gave you. Yeah, go there. She's got some new stuff on her shop. So check that out. And you can find her on Instagram at Kez Dyer. So K-E-Z-D-Y-E-R on Instagram. And it is a Z. It's not a Z. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z. See? That's perfect. That's how that ends. But yeah, she's worked on a huge variety of projects, from Wes Anderson's Isle of Dogs and the BBC's The Clangers, through to making her own line of art toys, and just someone who has done a huge amount of, just someone who's created actual physical things in the world, rather than people like me that just make bleeps and bloops that will one day get deleted from the internet. It was a really interesting chat though. I learned a huge amount, and this is definitely the one that I went in. I did my due diligence, I did my research, but anything involved with stop animation, filmmaking in general, toy making, are just areas I know very little about other than how to enjoy those things. So yeah, like, you will notice throughout that I say, oh, so it's like that. And Kerry will have to go, well, no. But that's a good thing. I learned stuff, you know? And that's what life's about. Every day's a school day, to quote Anne Robinson on The Weakest Link. That shouldn't have come back into my head. But yeah, really good. Really happy with how this one's turned out. But then I'm happy with all of them, because basically I've yet to make a fool of myself, which is a nice thing. Before we get started, though, I've got to get my usual plugs in. Again, thank you to the Patreons, people who choose to support this podcast. You are the only reason I can afford to continue doing it. So huge thank yous for that. It means a vast amount. Not only making a difference to my life, but let's face it, making a difference to the entire world. We're making the world a better place by putting this podcast together. So if you want to help the other Patreons support doing this, it's patreon.com/DanLesac. Also, the music, as ever, is on danlesac.bandcamp.com. Get over there. It's all pay what you want, so you can download it for free and stuff. So without further ado, let's get on with it. Kerry Dyer, Kerry Makes Things, and me chatting all things stop motion, puppeteering, magic. Enjoy.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The word offensive about pigeons.
So how are you?
I'm good, yeah.
So, who are you?
Who am I? Oh, do I have to do a full like intro?
No. Because we're going to talk for like an hour.
I guess.
You'll be spoilers otherwise.
Should I give you clues? No. My name's Kerry Dyer.
You can do it by a mime. Yeah.
Mime.
You should do it by a mime.
That would work really well on a podcast.
Weirdest podcast. Down a ravine?
The Mimecast.
I do wonder, is there a way of doing a mime-based podcast?
No.
Your audio describe would just be giving it away if you're doing charades.
Well, you could, so it could be a person's interpretation of the mime. It's not necessarily what's actually being done. It's
like the bad lip-syncing YouTubes of podcasts.
Yeah.
That would actually be quite
lip-reading, bad.
Lip-reading, not lip-syncing.
Yeah.
Lip syncing is the other one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one. So Kerry Dyer.
Yep.
You can cough right into it if you
can
want.
Can I?
Yeah. Because they're recorded separately. I can just,
oh, right.
I can just dip your little cough
out.
Oh,
okay.
But it will still get picked up by my mic, mm-hmm. which is always very confusing. So it always sounds like...
It's like a tiny far away cough.
It's very natural, though. Kerry Dyer. Kerry Makes Things.
Yes.
You've just been to the Toy Art Festival in Leeds.
Yeah, yesterday.
How was that?
That was great. It was lovely. It was really nice being in an air-conditioned room for the, what was it, 30-odd degrees it was. No, that one was really nice. It's a nice atmosphere. It's small. There's a larger one that happens down in London, ToyCon UK. It's been going longer.
Literally anything you describe, there's a larger one in London.
Yesterday had a really nice atmosphere to it. It's a lot of really friendly artists and everyone's just really... lovely.
Are the ones in London like me nice?
No.
Is it like Mean Girls? Everyone looking at each other's toys like, idiot.
I mean, that's the way I imagine it in my head. No, of course not. No, it's run by really lovely people, but it's just a bigger event. So you don't get time to go around and talk to everyone.
Yeah.
Because you've got to be like at your stand talking to people and selling
You're
stuff.
Trapped at your stand.
No, because I do that one with friends. So like, I share a stand with a friend.
Oh, you're allowed to walk away.
Like, walk away and chat to the odd person. But there's no way you can talk to everyone. There's not time. There's not. Yeah.
So, but it's art toys. Mm-hmm. So for people who don't know what we mean by art toys, there's dunnies and munnies and smorkins and labbits.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all of them. Quee.
Madel.
Key.
Yeah.
What's it, what was there's a words before key, isn't there?
No.
Metal.
Oh, heavy metal key was a specific show.
Oh, okay. Key, so key is just the figure. Skeleton Skelly Bro.
Yeah.
I had a key ring of the Skelly Bro and it fell apart. Mm. So I just had the little bit of plastic that would have gone between his body and his head.
Yeah.
On the
as a key ring.
For a long time.
Looks like just, a tiny bottle opener.
Exactly that. Just a ton. Four toys.
Yeah.
Toy bottle opener.
So it's that. It's the those are the vinyl production toys. Mm. You also get people doing their own short run production resin toys.
Mm-hmm.
Or customizing vinyl stuff. So like some of my stuff, I cut open their faces and sculpt things inside their heads.
Yeah. The customizing of the vinyl stuff is probably the bit I know, not know the most about, but am experienced
in. That's what you tend to get more of at toy fairs. You get people customizing things or making their own production resin. You get less of, at least in the UK ones, you get less of the big retailers just selling pop figures or whatever.
Yeah. But companies like Kid Robot and stuff brought in a lot of different artists to make, and that's the attraction with them. They're blind box. A lot of the smaller ones are done in like blind boxes.
With the dunnies. Yeah, they I can't remember how many are in a box. It's usually like, I think it's like 25 or something like that.
Yeah.
And then they'll have like values on the side of the boxes to tell you how rare certain ones are, and you get collectors who either want to get like the whole set or they want the most rare ones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like shinies with football stickers.
Yeah, kind of like that. Like, I've got some in the cabinet behind me.
In the cabinet of joy.
Yeah, the half-filled cabinet because we moved. But it's, I don't, like, none of those are rare ones. Those are just ones I like.
I'm annoyed because, like, the rare ones I've got are all ones that have additional pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So there was one, he was like it's a dunny. Dunny's the ears one. Money's the sans ears.
Yeah.
And he had a...
Well, they've got like, little human ears.
Little human ears, yeah. It's more monkey money,
yeah,
which would make sense,
yeah,
it being an M. But he had a little bowler hat and a little umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
Umbrella, gone.
Gone, yeah.
Not a clue.
Yeah.
Not a clue how or when it happened.
I've got a whole box of just accessories from when I've customised things and I didn't use the accessory. So
you've destroyed valuable things.
So that's one of the things with the way Kid Robot does things with their blanks. They do... blanks, so like plain white vinyl of monies, but they don't do them of dunnies, or they do occasionally, but they'll do them for specific artists. So if you want to, as a like non-high profile artist, want to do a dunny custom, you've generally got to use one of the ones out with artwork on them.
Yeah, I didn't even cross my mind that you couldn't get blanks.
Yeah, I buy non-rare ones on eBay, which are cheaper.
Cheap as chips, and then,
Yeah, I find the cheapest possible dunny I can find on eBay.
But, like, how did you get into that? Like,
so the, I...
Because, weirdly, we're going to talk about your day job.
Yeah.
But your day job came
way before. My day job is, I'm one of those people who's actually doing the thing they studied at university, which is rare. I know,
Get out. I know. You opened that window earlier. Get out
that window. How I got into it was I moved to London a few years back, and my partner was working in London, and I was unemployed at the time, and I had nothing to do. And someone asked me if I would make them a run of toys for a video game that they were making, and I didn't know how to make toys, so I just started Googling things and trying to find stuff. And it turned out there was a toy show happening at Forbidden Planet in London, which was the heavy metal key show that I mentioned earlier.
Okay,
so I went to that.
To just learn how.
Yeah, just to see what it was,
really.
And it was lovely, and I met all these really nice people, a lot of whom I'm still friends with now. And like, I saw a bunch of them yesterday at the Leeds event. But they were just so friendly and like lovely and welcoming. And and yeah, one of them asked me if I wanted to be in their Christmas show that they were doing at the time. Kid Robot had a shop in London, so
yeah,
there were tons of shows and events there.
Kid Robot definitely had like a period of time where they had pop up shops and all this, and then obviously they seem to have backed off. They had clothes.
Yeah.
Andrea Wonders.
I've got t-shirts and hoodies and yeah.
I think, I'm not sure. She'll kill me if I... She won't kill me. She'll hurt me.
I don't think she would kill you.
She'll hurt me.
I assume she likes you.
I think her cardigan that I hate, she's got this green one with like Paddington toggles on.
Yeah.
She's got two of them. Uh-huh. She likes it that much.
Yeah.
Is Kid Robot.
Yeah, I've got a blue one that my boyfriend hates.
Yeah.
Absolutely hates it. Yeah.
Yeah, but we... It's not that we hate you, it's that we hate the cardigan.
Yeah.
To be fair, like, Andrea's, the way she dresses, I can't even see it now.
Mm.
Like, she's covered in tattoos, and then for some reason feels like that makes it acceptable for her to wear ridiculous prints as well. Like, she, when she moves, it's physically nausea. So, like, she confuses the eye so much.
Oh, no.
Yet in an urban setting, she blends in perfectly. It's like
camouflage.
Digital camouflage, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, Andy. This is standing.
She's not going to thank you for that one.
She'll be fine. I think I actually quoted her, confuse the eye. But yeah, so you went to a show. What was the game you were making the toys for?
I never did make them, so I'm not going to say what it was. I think it wasn't, it was partly because I told them it was going to be way cheaper for them to go to a company that was set up for it already than it was for me to like hand make a prototype and then mold it and cast it. And I've said that actually over the years since I've been doing toys and animation stuff, I've had a lot of people approach me about making stuff for them and friends who want me to make things for them. And it's just, sometimes it's just cheaper to go with mass production than me in my shed.
Me and Scroobius Pip, this guy I know.
I think I've heard of him.
Just vaguely, We used to, our first ever t-shirts were made by this girl called Bombi Forest down in Cornwall. Because we wanted hand screen printed. We wanted it to be beautiful and stuff. But we were paying like £9 a t-shirt.
Yeah.
But we still wanted to sell them for £15. So for that first like year of our career, we were just not making any money on all this merch.
And
like that thing of you want to support an industry. Fuck off, whoever that is. It's my own fault. You want to support an industry. You want to support an artist. But the systems are cost prohibitive.
I had that problem when I ran. So a few years into making toys, I made my own resin blank that was a mold. Yeah, I've got some of them in the cabinet there as well.
We can talk about that as well.
And I did a custom show where
it's Mole XL.
Yeah, because I
and
used to make
mini
mole.
Is mini mole called mini mole?
There's one there in that. Do you see that? Papercraft treasure chest. There's one inside that.
Okay. Oh yes, I can see his little face.
Yeah.
So is he Minimal? Is that?
Yeah, that's Minimal. So those were the first things I made at my first convention to sell, and they sold really well.
2014.
Yeah, I think, is that right?
Ladies and gentlemen, that's called research. Oh yes.
I don't have any notes in front of me on my own life. You just remembered that.
I just remembered that.
Oh, well done.
That's the great thing. Can't remember my own age, but you know.
That'll be in there forever.
That's there now.
So yeah, that I made for the first ever ToyCon UK in London. And they sold really, really well there. In fact, I sold more of those than I did anything else. So I decided to make the larger version, the Mole XL version.
Are they vinyl? Or
no, they're resin.
They're resin.
But they are hollow, so they're rotocast, but not... I didn't go so far as to build a rotocast machine. I did it by hand, which is...
It's rotocast spinny cast.
Spinny, yeah. It's where you spin it in more than one direction.
You make a mold and you spin it in all, and that spreads the
It moves
the goop
on two different axes. But
yeah.
And that what that does is turns it all the way around.
So it evenly distributes the resin. Yeah,
except I didn't want to build one of those, so I just did it by hand. I bought a resin that cures, well, not totally cures, but sets in 3 minutes. So all I had to do was turn it continuously for 3 minutes. Are you doing it
quickly or
slowly? Slowly, just to coat it. Yeah. Like, okay. I mean, that's the... It's a podcast. No one's going to see this. That's the hand motion.
That's the hand motion there.
Yeah.
If you can guess at home what that hand motion was, it was nowhere near as lewd as you had thought. No. You know. But that's like you did that in your home or in a little workshop shed. Somewhere in a shed.
In a shed. Yeah.
Like I think as technology progresses, as our understanding of things progress, and our access to information, mm-hmm. like people listening now can go. Google rotor mold or mm-hmm.
rotor casting.
Mm-hmm. See, I forgot instantly. And go and see that. Okay, I could do that in my house and make something.
You can also buy the machines that do it as well. Like you don't have to build just one
proved,
yourself.
You've just proved you don't need the machine.
No, just need a bit of like upper body strength to do it. Depending on the size of the mold.
How many did you make?
Oh God, I don't know. I mean, for that show, I think there were 60 artists, so minimum 60.
So you made...
I do have more that I sell at shows still.
You launched them as mm-hmm. such at ToyCon earlier that year.
Yeah.
And then you put on an exhibition based around those, yes. getting artists from all over to do what Dunny's done, do what Kid Robot have done.
Either paint on them or sculpt on them and customise them in some way.
There's a Flickr album of remold, so R-E-M-O-L-E-D.
Yeah, listeners. That was the name of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Flickr album. You remember Flickr? When you remember that's still up. It's still there.
Yeah, somehow I thought Flickr was still a thing in 2014. I guess it was.
No, it was. It was. Yeah. It definitely was. Yeah. Someone bought it and then it stopped being a thing. Oh. I was still using Flickr still there, in 2014.
Though. Yeah.
But going through that album, it's fascinating to see how it's not just 60 people repainting them, painting funny faces on them. You know, it's people using, it's a mole, but someone did a diglet using turning the mole's nose into the sort of peak of a point of a hat and stuff. Yeah. And like how someone can look at a shape and think, okay, if I add this and take away that, I can turn this into something else, which is kind of fascinating.
There were some really interesting ones in there. I'm trying to think. My friend Ollie turned it into a bird. His artist name's Ockle. He's the guy I share a stand with at ToyCon every year. He turned it into this bird with these really spindly legs and somehow it was still supporting itself perfectly.
Someone did a Mario.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Mario's nose looked a bit like a penis. Like, not whoever that artist is, it was just the first shot I saw.
Oh, no, that was the... That might have been the Dr. Robotnik.
No, Robotnik looked like Dr. Robotnik, but stretched in strange proportions, in a nice way, in a stylized way. But the Mario definitely looked... And the Manic Miner was really nice. But the diversity of, like, you've got one form that you can work from. And, yeah, to me it's fascinating because we talk a lot on the podcast about limitations, about how, like, you're having to work around a restriction is far more conducive to being creative.
Yeah, and actually I should mention the theme of the show was video games, or at least... It was being held in a video game bar, and I told people
in
that
there London.
In that there London, loading bar. And so everyone kind
of... I just got that. I'd read the name and didn't really think about it, but then loading bar.
So a lot of people went for a video game theme, theme for their pieces.
Which makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah. But how did, like, from your point of view, you must have spent months getting the artists... involved, getting it all together.
Yeah.
And then the pieces are being sold as well, so I'm assuming...
There's a percentage cut there, yeah.
Yes, but you're having to deal with all that.
Yeah.
How did you find having to for a short space of time, run that as a business.
Well, that was in one of the patches where I didn't have any
day work.
Day job. Yeah, yeah. Ah, okay. That's what I'd, right, maybe I should mention that. What I do is contract work. So I'll have several months or maybe 2 weeks or maybe a couple of years on a project, and then I'll have a stretch of nothing.
So for you listening, Kerry's day job is stop motion animator, model maker,
puppet maker. More specifically these days. I don't really animate anymore.
Hang on. We're just the list. head of puppet hospital, fur technician, model maker, prototyper. I'm leaning in, guys. I don't know what that word is. It looks like solicitor, but sculptor, animator, prop maker. That's a list of jobs you've had in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Fry cook as well.
No.
Have you never had to cook fries for a living?
No, I've had a billion like part-time and temp jobs, but no.
Never had to cook the fries?
No, I'm vegetarian, so I stay out of the kitchen.
There must be some vegetarian
fast food places. Not back then, no. Maybe
today.
15 years ago, but like...
No. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe now. That would be an option.
Maybe.
I don't know.
I'm trying to actually think if there is an out-and-out fast food delivery place, but I don't think there is.
Oh, there's one in London that I really like. They don't do delivery, but they do like vegan fried chicken. It's called Temple of Hackney. It's in Hackney. Yeah. Really good.
That's good.
I missed that place.
It'd be really confusing if they were in like Waterloo or somewhere, unless that's Hackney.
No.
Hackney's a borough, isn't it? It's yeah. Like big.
And it's a town.
And a town.
Yeah.
Like New York.
Yeah.
It's just like New York, Hackney.
Totally.
they're basically the same place. But obviously doing that sort of work, you're contracted for a period of time, you're either working on a movie or a TV show, or
adverts,
we're going to get into that shortly, but so that gave you the time to work on the exhibition.
There we go,
that's what we were talking about.
Yeah, so I had a bunch of free time on my hands, so I was like, I'm gonna do a toy show. I've got a friend who runs a bar. I'm going to ask him if I can use his bar to host a toy show.
I think that's how a lot of things work.
Yeah.
I've got a friend with a thing I need.
Yeah, and it was in this period after Kid Robot London had shut down, so there weren't as many toy shows. There were a couple of people who were organising the odd like group toy show, and they were doing it in like bakeries and places that their friends had. That they could have a space for an exhibition or a period of time. And yeah, Jimmy, who runs Loading Bar, was quite happy for me to just set up some display cabinets in the bar and have stuff there for a month.
I feel like it being a bar probably means you've got more opportunity for drunken purchases as well.
Oh, I hadn't thought about it that way. Maybe that's how it went down.
There's a few regrets.
I was sober that whole night, so I don't know. I mean, maybe.
There's a few people who like wake up and look at a thing they bought and thought, man.
I'm sure they were all very happy with their purchases.
I don't know, that Mario's nose looked like a penis. No, it didn't. It's just, it looked like a penis to me.
To you,
because I see penises everywhere. How do you find working when you're modifying a toy? So some of the stuff you do, like you're cutting the faces off dummies, and then, because they're hollow, you're filling that space.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're fantastic, face-tastic. Four. Is it face then? No.
Yeah. I think I called it something like that.
Yeah. So
that one's down in the Dynamite Gallery in Brighton.
Mm.
It was for a superhero themed show.
Yeah. So it's Fantastic Four, but the big dummy is the thing.
The thing. Yeah.
And then the other the fiery one and the invisible one and stretchy boy are all inside the head. Uh-huh. But like. How do you, the thing that struck me with Remold and that is that you're having to kind of keep in mind the structure of what you've got.
Mm-hmm.
You're building off somebody else's skeleton at the same time as not.
I think probably the most successful customs tend to be the ones where you keep the shape.
Mm.
You can see what it was.
Mm.
Otherwise it becomes its own thing, but it's kind of nice to be able to see what you've built from.
Yeah.
To have that moment where someone looks at it and goes, oh, it's one of those. I had that yesterday. I've got this shark flower thing. It was a shark, and I've turned it into a flower. But people could kind of like see that the shark that it used to be, or that was another resin production by what's his name? Itty G, I think. His name?
I don't know. Don't look
it's
at
not,
me.
Is that not in your notebook?
It's not. I've got this Google thing if we need it.
Oh, okay.
So you don't find the structure restrictive? Is no. Finding the solution to the problem?
No, that's part of the fun of it. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Like looking at a shape and seeing what it could be, or how far you can stretch it while it's still recognizable as the thing that it was. Yeah.
I hadn't really thought about it, but the ones I like the most are the ones where I can still see it, what it was. Mm-hmm. That, yeah, especially when it's an exhibition where everyone's had to use the same
platform. Yeah.
Platform. Mm-hmm. It's kind of nice to see how it can evolve.
Yeah.
The level of detail on some of the remold, like people have built those things out and added crazy texture and like... Yeah, I can't really get sugar in my tea without spilling it everywhere, so it's something I don't quite understand.
Yeah.
If your day job is manual, creative, with your hands a lot of the time,
yeah,
how do you find that your other day job or your hobby or your relaxation creative thing
is also
exactly the same thing?
Yeah, I suppose because it's not exactly the same thing, because... My day job is, it's different things at different times, but for example, the job I'm doing right now,
You're working on the clangers right now.
Yeah.
Can you say that?
Yeah,
can
yeah,
we
yeah.
talk about
it? No, I can say that. Yeah. No, I'm doing puppet maintenance and rigging.
I didn't know if it was secret. How secret
is
the BBC were about who's working on the clangers?
Well, that's not secret at all. I've put it on Instagram. It's fine. But I do a lot of... metalwork and sewing. Usually in jobs, I do a lot of like silicon repair work and for puppet maintenance and that kind of stuff. So it's different from sculpting because I don't tend to do. Sometimes I get to do a bit of sculpting in my day job, but it's not the main thing that I do.
Yeah.
So I see it as different, and it's different as well because it's stuff that I'm coming up with myself.
Yeah.
As opposed to working on a big project with lots of people where, you know, a designer or art director or someone has come up with the look of it.
I suppose with something like the clangers, its legacy means you have no... Like, even the art director has very little creative control because someone 30 years ago set a tone and style for that. So you've got to be...
Yeah, well, she kind of works within that framework.
Yeah, she has to stay within that. And then, so having, when you get home, that opportunity to make a thing.
Yeah. Because it's my stuff. I get to decide.
Because for me, I've rarely worked on commission. I've only done very few things where I've had somebody say, that's not quite right. Because I usually am the end. Mm-hmm. I am my own client as such.
Yeah.
It's something I don't understand.
Not getting to make all the decisions.
Yeah.
Have to work within a specific framework. Or even, like, if you're with puppets, if you're making another puppet, it has to look exactly the same as the fit, like a copy. Because we always have multiples of every character, so they can be shot with on multiple different sets at the same time. So if you make another version of something, it has to work exactly the same way as the first version. Because otherwise the animator's not going to know
gonna be
how
able
to use
to...
it, or maybe it won't move in the same way, or it won't quite look right.
Oh, and yeah, I suppose because we as people have quirks in the way we move. So if you've built... what are the skeletons, the frames?
Armatures.
Yeah. If there's the armatures down to the very bones of the puppet,
they have to be identical. Yeah.
It's kind of... I hadn't even really thought about that. What attracts you to stop motion when, if you think about it, it's pretty labor intensive. Mm-hmm. It's kind of expensive as a thing to do because of the time. And I suppose that it, because of the ways we can do this digitally, whether that's hand drawn or 3D it's becoming more niche. What is it that keeps you excited about it as a...
I've been asked that a lot. I've been asked a lot over the years, like, if I would switch to CG, and I don't think I ever will. When I was a kid, I was adamant I didn't want to work in animation, which is weirdly specific for a child not want to do. But I grew up in Bristol, or just outside Bristol, so Aardman's a big deal there. Mm-hmm. And when I, you know, when I was a kid sculpting things and making stuff, everyone was like, oh, you should go work at Aardman, you should make puppets for a living. And I was adamant that I didn't want to do that.
For our Americans, Aardman made, what's the big one?
Wallace and Gromit.
Well done. So Wallace and Gromit, we had the Creature Comforts TV adverts over here.
Mm-hmm. And the full series as well.
And the full series.
Yeah.
But yeah, claymation? Is it still considered claymation?
I mean, I don't think the bulk of what they do now is solid clay.
No.
Creature Comforts certainly were.
Yeah.
Claymation, but mostly I'd say stop motion's probably a better term for it. Yeah. So yeah, I grew up near there, so everyone's like, yeah, you should just go work there. And I was like, no, I don't want to.
Me with the oil refinery. There's an oil refinery
but you didn't end up working there.
I did briefly.
You did? Oh, yeah. Right, okay.
Yeah. Filling gas bottles. Oh. I spent a summer filling propane and butane bottles. It was good. It was good. I nearly lost my legs at one point on a freak conveyor accident.
And yet somehow you still enjoyed the job?
Kinda. Yeah. I lost weight.
Yeah.
I got buff. Like loading those propane bottles onto lorries in a really quick fashion. It was good for me.
Yeah.
That one summer I was fit. Remember, guys? That one summer I could walk upstairs. Yeah. Good days.
I ended up doing an art foundation before I went to university. And
where did you go to university?
Newport in South Wales. University of South Wales.
Yeah.
It merged with like another university.
Because I went to Reading College and School of Art and Design, which then became Thames Valley University, which is just like the entire Thames Valley, Acton, all the way out to some of TVU's in Oxford, and it's like...
So that's quite a commute that some of the students have to do if they've got, like, lectures on different campuses.
Yeah, because I did photography, and now photography's moved into London, so those poor kids don't get to shoot... Oh, there's nothing worth shooting in Reading. They're probably happier.
I did the foundation course in Bristol. And an art foundation course is basically... every week or every 2 weeks, they give you a different topic, like photography or filmmaking or whatever. And they give you all the materials and you just make stuff for a couple of weeks. And then at the end, you pick one and you do a project. In that, I picked stop motion. Because... Actually, I really enjoyed making little puppets and moving them around, it turned out. And I'd spent years just adamantly saying, I don't want anything to do with this, because animators spend all day in the dark, indoors by themselves.
I do find it cute that, like, Aardman animation is the local thing you want to escape to some extent. There's probably people in Australia right now going, man, I really want to work at Aardman animation. I'm going to fly to England.
I was an idiot. Total idiot as a teenager.
But you ended up working there as well.
Yeah, I did, eventually. They let me in.
You failed every dream you had as a child, basically.
Well, I mean, yeah, my dream to not do something.
Did you ever get a pony? Is that?
I didn't want one. I tried horse riding.
I only wanted a pony as a kid because I saw a... Although he's not popular at the moment because he's a racist, but a pony that looked like Morrissey had the weird sort of not quiff, floppy-ish hair.
Uh-huh.
And it was just a dashing pony.
The Morrissey pony.
And the weird thing is the first time I saw this pony, it was in like a magazine, it was eating a daffodil.
Mm-hmm.
So it looked like Morrissey because he used to run around with daffodils.
Right.
And it's just like... Yeah, the Morrissey pony. I didn't want to ride him. I wanted him to be my friend.
Yeah.
Sorry, I keep doing this today. I'm in that... I think I didn't sleep enough, so my mind just goes, yeah, you remember that pony,
Dan? That thing from years ago.
Come into your head there. So university to do stop motion.
And then animation, yeah. It was an animation course where you could specialise if you wanted to.
Yeah.
So it did CG and it did 2D animation as well. And like everyone starts out on the course doing 2D animation with line testers and paper hand-drawn.
When you say 2D, you're drawing.
Yeah, hand-drawn. And then eventually I taught myself Flash. I think my boyfriend taught me Flash. Doesn't matter. I learned Flash.
Macromedia Flash then.
Yeah, yeah.
Back in the days.
That's 14 years ago.
Yeah. That's when I learned Macromedia Flash.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to be after I did my degree. I was like, no, I'm going to become a web designer.
I think...
At that time, like, Flash web designers were getting paid, like, obscene money. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to be great at it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just went to the pub a lot.
I think I did... We had a project where everyone was trying to do one of those... Do you remember the E-Stings? I think they still do them for Channel 4 or E4. Yeah. Yeah.
We've had someone on who's done loads of those.
Right. I did one in Flash when I was at university.
Nice.
And it didn't go anywhere.
So Syriac from like episode 4.
Yeah.
So he's done E-Stings and the Channel 4 ones, and he does loads for, has done a load for Adult Swim.
Mm-hmm.
And then like, for me, it was really interesting because he started... Because he was bored in basically a date your entry job. So he was just making silly gifts to make people laugh.
Yeah.
But it's that thing of passion. Like, you find a thing you love and
you just do that over
hopefully
and over
you're going to take that to the nth degree.
Yeah. But I've gone.
You go on.
No, I forgot what I was going
to say. So have I. how did we get... You did
animation. I was studying...
Flash.
Yeah.
Post-Flash.
And then the first chance I got to make my own puppets and use their equipment to film my own stuff, I did that straight away.
Mm.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, like it was fun learning how to do hand drawn 2D animation and set it up on a line tester and photograph every single frame.
Yeah,
that was good, and it was a good basis for, you know, how to get an idea of motion and how things move. But the second they let me have a camera. And make my own puppets.
Are we still film at that point, or are they early digital? You're younger than me, so you've moved into digital. Because I was the crossover.
It was a weird mix in that, yes, it was all on digital camera, and I did the color correction and everything in Photoshop and post processing and all that kind of stuff and learning Premiere. But then when it came to submitting my grad film, it had to be submitted on DV tape.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to put it on from digital onto tape.
Yeah.
And then, submit the physical tape, which was crazy because I could have just put it on YouTube. You know?
Yeah.
Well, except you couldn't because they wanted everyone to try and submit their films to festivals. So YouTube was a thing, yeah.
Had it existed by then?
2007. 2007.
2007?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know why the three of them set up YouTube?
No.
So that very first video on YouTube is one of the founders in front of an elephant, and he's talking about the elephants having long trunks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that guy, him of the three that set up, the reason he got the idea for YouTube was because he was having difficulty finding footage of Janet Jackson's nipple slip or nip slip.
I remember that, yeah.
At the Super Bowl. It's really interesting to me that is the... creation point of YouTube.
There was no centralized resource for me to be able to find this one video.
I need to see that nipple slip. But it's also kind of telling of what YouTube is now, because YouTube is beautiful in corners. There's these little pockets of YouTube that are wonderful places. Like, actually, weirdly, while researching this, there's lots of really interesting stop motion stuff.
Mm.
And it's like, there's people... You've got the sillier sort of Lego stop motion stuff where people are just making funny things.
Yeah.
Or
people animating action figures. There's a whole load of YouTube.
That's kind of the entirety of Adult Swim at this point.
Yeah.
What is it? Robot Chicken?
Robot Chicken. Well, no, that's different. They're a big animation studio in LA.
Mm.
You know, they've got like big studio spaces and they're doing multiple shows. And
Yeah. Again, see that. Distracted. DV tape.
DV tape, yeah.
Look at that back. I know. I should be making that.
I've got DV tapes somewhere in my office.
I've got mini discs.
And a camera that I can play them on, but that's it. Yeah.
I suppose, like, it's a crazy craft in that the amount of time it would have been taking then before you could see your result. It's not like now where you could be, well, like...
Yeah, I was seeing the result straight away because it was digital.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, the tape was just the submission process. No, I was using Stop Motion Pro at the time, which was... It just went straight from the camera into the software. Computer. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So if that last frame didn't quite fit, you could
straight away. Yeah.
Adjust. Yeah. But once you've made that move, if mm-hmm. like, I don't know, you've got 50 frames mm-hmm. and frame 23 is shit,
mm-hmm.
it's got to be a pain in the ass to...
Yeah, you can't. I mean, you can and you can't. You can go back and delete frames mm. and see if it maybe works without it. You can't really go back and say, oh, I want
to
get rid of this.
I need to reposition
frame.
This.
You know, you could try. And I definitely did. Because as a student, you can maybe get away with that.
And I suppose no matter if your puppet is like highly detailed or mm-hmm. furry or whatever, you've increased like many more problems.
Oh, yeah. If it's something with fur, you're probably not going to be able to.
Because suddenly its fur is going to be pointing the wrong
it
way.
It does this thing called boiling where it moves and you mm. see it like... bubble and that's certainly a look that people go for.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's you've got to be very skilled to try to make something boil in a way that looks like natural fur movement. That's mm-hmm. definitely something that the animators on Isle of Dogs got really right, mm. I think, where it looks like the
which
fur.
You worked on.
I did for 2 years.
That's not you just bring it up for no reason. Yeah. You're there.
No, I think that film, that one and Fantastic Mr. Fox are excellent examples of how to animate with fur. Like, or there's a certain amount of maybe accidental boil in there as well, but there's a lot of intentional, like, movement. Sorry, that was
a good noise. I liked
it's
it.
The leg of the table as a gesture. there's a certain amount of intentional animated fur blowing in the wind.
So
done really well.
You worked on both Fantastic Mr. Fox and Isle of Dogs.
Yes,
Fantastic Mr. Fox as an intern.
As an intern for a month. Yeah.
I felt like you didn't want to take credit.
Well, you
were there just, no, yeah, I'll do that. You were in that role.
Kind of, although Fox. I was incredibly lucky because a lot of, I've done a lot of like work placements and internships over the years. Mm. For a good year and a half after my time at uni, I bounced back and forth between working for free on TV shows and...
Wait, they make you work for free? Oh, God, I've never heard of such a thing.
And then going back to working in a bank or a hospital or a bra factory at one point. Like, I've done a bunch of weird temp jobs.
Did you learn anything from the bra factory that moved over into your career?
No. I mean...
But you might. There might maybe. Be a thing.
I was quality control checking bras, so I was measuring them to make sure they were within the acceptable
at some point
range,
you're
going to
be
range.
At some point you're going to be collecting a BAFTA mm-hmm. for a stop motion film you've made, and you're going to have to go, and you know what, I would like to thank the bra factory because the technique they used to bend the underwire just came in handy for this one.
Maybe someday I'll use that.
Or the movie will be animated bras, some sort of personified bras, different character traits. I just gotta write a script real quick. Fantastic Mr. Fox and Isle of Dogs are like huge long-term productions as well. I don't think people realize just how much work goes into it.
Stop motion films take a long time to make. I mean, they take a long time to get into production when you've got your script writing and your pre-production, but like building the puppets and shooting a stop motion film can take like between a year and 2 years.
There's a sushi preparation scene and I can't remember who did the video, like a magazine-y mm-hmm. thing, maybe Variety or someone, 3-minute video about that, where basically they're just talking about all the different cool things they did. So making it so the puppet could literally cut the tentacle,
mm-hmm.
all done with magnets.
It was
magical.
Yeah, that was all designed over a guy called Andy Gent, who was the head of puppets in that film. At his workshops, they put together all of these processes and tested them and figured out like how they were going to work and how all the parts were going to.
But like in that, it's says 7 months from kind of planning original, like throughout all the stages that,
that I mean,
1 minute of footage took 7 months to put together.
Yeah, probably. That sounds about right.
That's,
I mean, there was a lot
insane.
Yes, and part of that, I think, was the design process, and some of it was things maybe not working the way that they were initially intended to on camera, and changing it and adapting it. Some of it is because, at least in my opinion, that Wes Anderson likes things to look a particular way, and it was a lot of back and forth, like getting things looking the way he wanted them to.
Yeah,
as well. But it looks amazing. Like it worked.
Yeah,
it
was, oh no,
it was definitely worth it.
Like, there's something about Isle of Dogs that, yes, you could have made that in CG.
Mm.
You could have. And I don't think it would have been a less of a story having been made.
Mm.
But
it wouldn't look the same.
I think us as humans, like, see the intrinsic quality of the work and somehow give it a little bit more, whether that be gravitas or attention. Like, when you see someone has put in this extra bit of effort, maybe we give it that extra second thought, which means, in terms of a movie, if you're paying just that bit more attention because they've put so much more art in there, I don't know. I think that adds to the movie.
I mean, it's certainly a difficult medium. Like, there's lots of things that can go wrong, and it's you know, you can have set shifting, or the lights can go in the middle of a shot.
Well, you talk about on another podcast how if the animator leaves a puppet in a certain pose, say, you can come in the next day and it's literally
torn
heads.
Open.
Heads come off.
I know exactly which scene you're talking about and which animator. Yeah,
I can imagine the first time that happens to you, that's horrific as well.
It really is. That was part of that was to do with even the time of year, because if the studio gets really cold at night and the silicon's left in an extreme pose, it'll be more brittle. It can just tear open.
Oh, I suppose because it's going to need time to, if you start animating before as well, before it's warmed up.
Yeah, so that on that particular shot that I was talking about, I think that animator started coming in. I don't know if he came in later or if he just started animating a bit later, but they put the heating on and try and warm it up. But certainly there were days where he'd start to move the puppet and it would just start, like a tiny, not go completely, but a little tiny tear would appear, and I'd have to go fix it. And then
that was your job, to go in there and
fix it and make it right before he starts turning it any further.
Was there a lot of just screams of, Kerry?
Yeah, I had a walkie-talkie, so yes, they could find me wherever I was.
Kerry! While you were on Isle of Dogs, you went from being just part of the puppet hospital team as such, but then you became Lord of that.
Lord of the team.
Sorry, Lordess, I think.
I'll take Lord. Lord's fine.
Baroness?
Lady.
Lady?
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't seem as fair. Like, Baron and Baroness, at least they're...
the same level.
Lord and Lordess, not Lord and Lady.
I suppose.
How was that to become the boss?
I mean, that was... It was because... I was on that team from start to finish. Like, I was there putting desks together at the beginning of the puppet hospital, which is a maintenance team, essentially.
Yeah.
And also, we would do, like, on-set checks to, you know, check the furs all gelled nicely and iron the clothes and make them look good in
the shop.
What do you
use to keep the hair in... Is it hairspray? Is it actually
like a really gel? A really thick, like, special effects gel called Gaffquat mixed with regular hair gel, so it still moves a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It is that much control, though?
Yeah, quite a bit.
Like, I mean, it didn't even cross my mind that you would need that much control, but I suppose if a scene's got wind,
you need to be able to move. Yeah, and it was also stuff that you could comb out and restyle and... That's simplifying it quite a bit, but it was...
Oh, I suppose because you're not trying to destroy the puppet as well. You don't, mm-hmm. if you need to, obviously you're going to do things in the course of your job that require the puppet to be destroyed.
Yeah, which is why you need a maintenance team.
Yeah, yeah.
to repair stuff like constantly and restyle things.
Mm.
You know, we've got like tiny irons, mini irons for ironing clothing. And
it's a highly detailed movie as well.
Mm.
Like the people who've made those puppets have had to go down to the minutiae of like the time on the watch. And
yeah, or tiny buttons and badges yeah. and tiny stitching and yeah.
It's really like, strange when you see behind the scenes stuff, because in my mind the puppets are both bigger and smaller than I'd expect.
Yeah, there are several different scales, at least on that film in particular. We had three main scales and then we had like extra small things.
So my friend Jim's got some of the original Thunderbirds
mm-hmm.
puppets,
mm-hmm.
Like actual ones that were used in the show. Massive.
Yeah. Like, this is what people always say, that stop motion puppets are much bigger than you think they're going to be. Even I was showing some people around the Clanger studio the other day, some of the CG team.
Yeah, how
team.
Big are the Clangers? Because in my mind, they're tennis balls. Oh, wow.
This big.
That big.
This works on podcasts, right?
Really? That
this big? How tall
so
is that?
So that's like a hunched child?
No, her? I mean, it's, what, 30 centimetres maybe?
A dragon egg.
Sure.
Yeah.
A dragon egg size.
From Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Everyone knows how big a dragon egg is.
Yeah, now they do.
Yeah, that's roughly how big they are. But yeah, like even people who were working on like the rig cleanup for the show who hadn't seen the puppets in person thought they were smaller than that because they see them on screen.
Because they just see them on screen.
Yeah.
How does digital affect analog as such in that industry? Do people who work in stop motion puppetry, is there a prestige to it, and is part of that prestige what keeps it alive?
Maybe.
Because commercially it probably doesn't make sense, like time and money wise.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, if we're talking commercially, I suppose adverts, sometimes it's quicker and cheaper to shoot a stop motion advert, not with full puppets, when it's objects and items, and like when you get like an advert for butter, that's not a good example.
But you've worked on a few adverts as well, haven't you?
Yeah. I worked on a Starbucks advert, which was mostly just moving a cup around. Yeah. Right. So I had people in as well, so it wasn't necessarily that much cheaper, but it was because there was not an extensive build time on making a fully armatured puppet.
Mm.
It can be quicker for adverts. And also I think people like the look of stop motion adverts as well. I feel like those have become more popular in the last 10 years.
It's the Instagram effect. Mm. So like, why is Instagram popular? And people right now would say, well, it's like the social media buzz, you get your likes and all mm-hmm. that. And it's like, well, yeah, but why did it become popular? Because when it launched, it didn't have any, you couldn't follow people, it was just a camera filter app. And it's that bit of nostalgia, like that it harks back to a time where things weren't so easy to do, which then somehow implies more value to the a thing as creative.
Because something's harder to do, it's more about
it's
more
better
worthy.
Somehow, yeah. There's a warmth that comes with knowing human hands have been there.
And there are certainly things that are made to look like they're stop motion or look like they're handmade. There have been adverts that I've seen where I'm not entirely sure if they actually made the thing or if it was CG. And I've asked the person who worked on it afterwards and they're like, nah, CG. it's you know, aping it well enough that you think it's...
I saw while digging around on YouTube, one that there was a guy who had like a foldy paper origami panther, and the thumbnail looked like he had made this, and then as soon as you hit play, it's like, this is in a computer, like the way the camera's moving, everything is just too pristine. It was still very good animation and far above anything I could ever make, but at the same time there was a bit of me that was like, if this was less complex and he'd actually animated an origami figure, in the real world, I think I'd be more blown impressed. Away.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely a sense of that. I mean, possibly because it's what I do for a living that I feel, I definitely feel that way, that when you find out something is CG, it's suddenly like, oh, okay.
Well, so it's like, because like you're working on the Clangers now, I don't know that I would be happy, like, if it had been
made in
CG.
That has more to do with the history of the show, I imagine, that because you know that the original series was stop motion.
Yeah.
That it needs to continue being that. Like, if... So there's... There are definitely shows that were stop motion that they've made CG versions of that kids enjoy them just as much as they enjoy the stop motion ones, because they don't really
care. Kids
are
idiots.
Yeah, but parents sometimes get annoyed that it's different from how they remember it, or it's,
and
it doesn't quite
they're
the
ones
same.
Who are
it's
hammering out on the Daily Mail forum. Oh, they've ruined my childhood.
Yeah, but that's not to say that I mean, there are many really good CG films and TV series, and it's just that flip from something that was handmade that suddenly isn't.
Yeah, yeah.
It feels different.
We can cope with, like, Star Wars, Clone Wars going, and we can still consider it canon-ish.
Yeah.
Like, the movies to that is fine.
Maybe because it's a switch from one medium to another entirely, that it's live action and
but
animation.
Weirdly, we struggle with taking the old Star Wars and putting modern digital into them. It's like, well, no, we didn't need... We didn't need you to fix that scene with Jabba the Hutt.
It wasn't broken.
It was just a bloke, you know?
Perhaps that's more about meddling with things from people's childhood. People, you know, you get really protective of something that you loved or have nostalgia for.
But was there a fear of that with the Clangers? Because you've been involved for a while, though.
For a year. Yeah. No, they restarted it, I want to say, 4 years ago now.
How many seasons? Is it still
this
done
is
in
three.
Seasons?
Yeah,
three.
Yeah.
So you've been in for at least the season.
Yeah.
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 But, like, that must be intimidating for the team. I know you've come in later, but...
Well, yeah, I've just strolled in once they're happy with everything.
In.
And the team... Because the team is mostly the same from when they restarted it. And they've all done a lot of work to get it right and get it looking right and feeling right. And I'm not going to take any credit for that at all. It was a well-oiled working machine by the time I got there. Yeah.
And with, like, puppet maintenance, like, how wide is your skill base there?
Every single process from start to finish.
So...
Like, you have to be able to repair anything.
So
any
the armatures, which would be a mechanical
metalworking
engineering. Thing,
yeah.
To haberdashery
and painting,
and model making,
silicon
to an
casting,
extent as
mold
well.
Making, costume for hair, all of it. You have to be able to.
That's
ideally,
a lot.
You have to be able to have that entire skill base.
Yeah,
which is a lot, but that. That's what I like about it.
Mm.
I like making puppets as well, and I go back and forth between being on build teams and maintenance teams, but I really like just being able to do every part of the process. Like that's why I love maintenance, but it's also why I like shorter builds, like adverts, because. You can do everything. Everything from start to finish. Yeah.
No, it's I think from with this pod, I realized that I knew the least about, you know, when talking to Philosophy Tube, I knew stuff. When talking to Mike, I knew stuff. And then when I came to this, I was like, oh fuck, I know nothing. So when I listened to one podcast first, and you're talking about armatures, and I'm like, in my mind, an armature wasn't the thing inside at first. It was like a literal, like, thing, like almost like a Meccano thing for holding things in place and stuff. It's like, and it's like, as you do your research, you realize how little you know about a thing.
I've definitely had. Well, I've shown people around workshops I've been in, and I've shown them the puppet, and then shown them the internal skeleton, the armature, and they've gone, "So, do you then program the computer to tell it how to move?" And you're like, No. This isn't animatronics. It's not like a person it bit by bit.
Have you worked on anything animatronic?
No, I haven't.
Is that something you'd want to do? Or are you happy where you are?
I think I'm happy where I am for now. That's a whole other thing. I almost went and worked on something where I would have been making the skins, the foam latex skins literal skin to go over. And that's probably, if I were to do a job involving animatronics, I imagine that would be what I would do.
Cause yeah.
I don't think I don't understand.
You've already filled your head with so
all
much
of these
stuff,
other like, skills and processes. Yeah.
I can't work. I don't want to learn pneumatics.
Can I learn about the electrical components that go inside? I don't know. maybe I could.
And there's still art to that. It's not like...
Definitely.
We need to get this thing to turn on and off. It's like we need to make that thing move in a specific way to make that blink look natural or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Too much. But that's why I suppose Hollywood has gone to that. Jurassic Park's a really good example.
Mm-hmm.
Like watching Jurassic Park and then watching Jurassic World.
Mm.
The CG in Jurassic World is actually very good, but there's something, the craft of shooting the animatronics in a way that made them believable.
Yeah,
is some of like Blackmagic, Smoke and Mirrors stuff. Like we're not.
I mean, Jurassic Park was interesting because it was a mix.
Yeah,
it was, and I thought they'd like, you think about how old that film is. It's 25 years old, I believe.
Jurassic Park, you know the scene where the T-Rex bites the raptor and throws the raptor?
Mm.
It's three frames, so the raptor just disappears from his mouth.
Oh, really?
It's really good. There's like 1,000 YouTube videos like of just that bit slowed down.
Yeah.
It is so weird, though, because like how that got to the end, you know, there's but so many moving parts in a movie, but
yeah.
I actually kind of like
it.
Oh,
there are
for
things
that
in Isle of Dogs that I'm not happy with. But I think everyone would feel that way about it.
Yeah,
I know they do. I know there are animators who see things. They see mistakes that I don't see, and I see things that they don't see. Yeah.
But
the audience doesn't see it as a mistake.
But this thing about, like, film, like, a full motion and stop motion, like, everyone involved is working on the absolute minutia, frame by frame by frame. You know, one of the characters in Isle of Dogs has freckles.
Yeah.
And I didn't catch all the names on the podcast I listened to, but yeah, one of the guys saying that he had to physically in every face put tiny little dimples there so that
were,
the painter could paint the exact same freckles every time.
Exactly. So they are slightly indented in the face. Because those, quite a lot with stop motion films now, you get, with replacement faces, you have 3D printed faces.
So that you can get different expressions going.
Yeah, exactly. But Isle of Dogs was interesting in that they were all hand sculpted and moulded and cast and hand painted. And
you need multiple. And they all need to be identical.
Yep. Yeah, so the guy you're talking about on that podcast was called Josh.
Hey, Josh.
Yeah, he's on, you can find some of his stuff on Instagram under Sculpt Double. He and his twin brother are both sculptors in the animation industry. Their stuff's amazing.
They're twins?
Yeah.
Are they twins? Yeah. Okay.
That's why I picked Sculpt these Double. Things. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It does make sense.
But yeah, Josh, that was the two of them both did sculpting on that film. And they would have to do, I think they started with like the maquette of the character, so you sculpt out what the character's supposed to look like. And then you've got to go off and make the face and then make a version of that face. So I think, I'm not sure because I wasn't on that part of the build, but I believe they had like a version of the face that you could pour plastiline into a mold so you can get the base level of the face and then sculpt the expressions from there.
Oh, okay.
There's still an enormous amount of work. huge amount of work because the characters had face sets with like 50 faces in them.
Mm.
You know, that's...
Yeah,
it might
even
have been more than that because they had like little mouth plugs for talking as well. So the mouths were a whole other set and yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing about it to me that like it didn't need to be stop motion, but
no.
It's right that it was.
Yeah, and there's also a lot of a cleanup and post-processing on stop-motion films. Mm. If it's something where a character has to talk, they've got to clean up all of the lines around the mouth and the lines around the face from replacing the faces. And, you know, that's one way of doing it. The dogs in that film in particular had little metal paddles, like, around their mouths and, like,
the
under
dogs
their
didn't
eyebrows.
Have
no, they're not replacements.
You could animate the whole
exactly.
Face.
So they've got... a more complicated skull that has paddles underneath it so you can move the eyebrow up and down or the cheekbone or like the several, I think there were like 6 paddles on the upper jaw and maybe 4 on the lower jaw so you could make them look like they were talking.
One wrong move.
Yeah.
How is it for you to work on these projects to like build these little families and then...
It's that. It's exactly that. It feels, if it's a good team of people, it feels like a family. Like you get to know everyone so, so well. So like that, the puppet hospital on Isle of Dogs, there was a team of 10 people. And sometimes on jobs, you know, like the job I'm doing right now, I'm working with people that I worked with in Scotland 10 years ago. So I haven't seen them for 10 years. And it's really nice getting to see them again and catching up. But the team on Isle of Dogs... I got to know them all so well. And like I saw them a few weeks ago at a wedding.
Mm.
One of them got married. So we all got back together again and had a catch up. And it felt like no time had passed.
Yeah.
Even though it's been a year and a half, I think. Yeah. Since we finished shooting. And it just felt like it was Monday morning again and we're all catching up about what we did at the weekend, even though it's what have you been doing for the last year and a half. Yeah, that was lovely. That was really nice. And because you end up, it's such a small industry, you end up working with the same people over and over again. When you start a new job, if it's people you don't know, you can say, oh, I did this job. Do you know this person? Yeah, I know them. So everyone sort of knows each other. And I think eventually, after another 10 years, I'll know everyone.
I'm assuming it's a fairly small industry.
It is, yeah.
Like, because it's so specialised, because it's...
Yeah, yeah. There are still people that you don't... Like, there are hubs of animation in the UK. There's Bristol, because of Arben, but also because of other smaller studios. There's London, which tends to be the people who do more the commercial work, or, like, when there's a feature film, everyone kind of, like, flocks to where that's happening. It's usually in East London.
Yeah.
And everyone's there for 2 years, and then they all disperse again. And then Manchester, where I am now, where there's... like 2 main companies, but historically there have been other stop motion companies in and around Manchester.
Is the Clangers up here then?
Yes.
Yeah. So the Clangers is Salford.
Altrincham.
Oh, Altrincham.
Which is where we are.
Okay.
Right
yeah,
now.
Yeah.
And McKinnon Saunders is here as well.
Okay.
So Clangers is made at a company called Factory who makes stop motion shows.
What's BBC at Salford? Is that news?
CBBC is based there.
Oh,
as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Who one of the companies that the show's made for,
think
so it's on CBBC.
You are our second CBBC person, weirdly.
Yeah.
So Dan Hare, who is a technologist, and that's what I'm going to call him, worked on some of the CBBC apps for the BBC and worked for BBC R&D for a while.
Oh, yeah. I've been for a tour around there. This was 4 years ago, so I'm sure what they're doing is way more impressive now. But they were showing us... Or maybe I can't talk about it.
Maybe not. I think...
It was really cool.
me and Dan had this. He was like,
actually...
No, I can't say. We've got lasers. The BBC has lasers.
Well, so I work for the animation company and they produce the show for BBC.
Yeah.
I did work on a show years ago that was made by the BBC, which was called Ooglies.
Ooglies.
Yeah, I was an animator on that. That was up in Glasgow.
Mm.
And that was, they were trying out, because the BBC used to have an in-house animation team. I think they were based in Bristol, actually. And then years back, they closed it down and, you know, they outsourced to animation companies. And I feel like Ooglies was them trying to produce their own animation again, because it wasn't in-house exactly, because they put us up in this warehouse in Maryhill in Glasgow, which is an interesting area. Yeah, they put us in this warehouse space, and we were just kind of like building everything from scratch because there was no animation studio there.
Yeah.
So they moved people from like around the country, and everyone kind of just converged on Glasgow, and we made this show for the first two series of it. And they didn't, when they went to make series three and four, they got an animation company to do it. So it was this odd experiment that didn't quite work.
I suppose with the unique way the BBC is funded, that they, it's probably very hard for them to justify. They have had in their life some really innovative in-house projects, like the BBC Radiophonic Workshop
and
all this, but it's really hard to justify that to a Daily Mail reader in Oxford.
Yeah. Plus, there's the cost of setting up a stop motion space is high, because you need a lot of space for it, and you need a lot of specialised equipment and people who maybe don't live nearby, so you've got to move those people near where you're going to be shooting. With that series, I feel like the initial setup cost wouldn't have helped.
At all.
With justifying, this is the thing that we can keep doing. And a stop motion studio that already exists has all that. You know, they have the space and they have the equipment.
The BBC also has that problem that a large amount of their income actually comes from selling stuff abroad. So you also have that problem of like, can we justify spending this? Are we generating enough income from that? It's a conversation for another time, but as we as creators and consumers, I hate the word consume, but as enjoyers of things,
viewers,
lovers, dreamers. but I think we forget that sometimes the things we see have been somewhat molded by capitalism,
circumstance. Definitely.
There's that movie you love. There was an accountant at some point who said, you can't do that. And maybe part of why you love it is because someone creative had to come along and not just be creative, but use a creative solution.
Within a budget.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Budgetary constraints make a lot of difference to stop motion.
Can be definitely good. But at the same time, that could also be the thing that, you're not allowed to use alpaca wool for the fur. You need to use fuzzy felt. It's like, kind of gone wrong.
Yeah.
You know? I have one more question. I think we've covered a lot, really. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you wanted to say or do? We talked a bit about toys, then we just talked rambling about stop motion.
Yeah, it was a bit rambly.
This is how I do it.
No, I've listened to your podcast. I know that's how you do it.
This is the style now.
Yeah.
The last one was the last one I recorded, released, which isn't the last one. Don't get confused, guys. But had to be two parts because it is so rambly.
Yeah, I've listened to part one.
So Stoya, she was the professional in that conversation. So we would go off track and she would bring it back. But she wouldn't do what I do of going, that's where we were. She would just go, da 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 da, and then she's just back into where we were like 3 minutes before.
All right, well, let me do that. I'll take it back to a question that I didn't finish answering.
Okay.
So Isle of Dogs, the puppet hospital
there.
You've heard of it, yeah. You've seen it. You've loved it, obviously. I started on that as like the first person in the door, building all the desks, ordering equipment, materials, all that kind of stuff. And then there were two other people that ran the department before I did. One guy was there for a little bit before he had to go back to his other job. Same thing with, he was called Andre. Charlie, when she took over, she had plans. There was like a point where we were supposed to finish filming and it ran on a little bit. And she had other plans, so she left. And by that point, when she would go off on holiday or go away for a week, I was covering running the department. So I already had like a little bit of experience doing that. And that was the interesting thing there was going from You know how I said it was like a little family?
Mm-hmm.
Going from like being one of the people in like part of the team to running it.
Being mum.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Like that it felt like there was a slight shift that I couldn't maybe make that joke I would normally have made.
Yeah. So how have you ever had to be the boss and have interns in there?
Yeah.
So having been the intern,
mm-hmm.
Do you have a better understanding of interns, or is there that I guarantee at some point someone was impatient with you on, say,
yeah.
Fantastic Mr. Fox or yeah. something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Someone I'm friends with now who was just pissed off at me for not getting what they were saying or doing it the wrong way. Yeah. Yeah. I've definitely seen that from both sides. And I remember how frustrating it was to be an intern and you'd see maybe, or you'd hear about an intern or a work placement person who got offered a job on something. And you're like, well, why didn't that happen for me? And the answer there is circumstance and luck and timing, yeah. because maybe they were there at the point where a job opened up.
Exactly.
And it was offered to them. And I've definitely been the person who's recommended an intern for a job.
Mm.
And then that intern, it didn't fit in with what that intern was doing, or maybe like they wanted to finish their university course and they
idiots.
Were well, I've been that person as well, where I was offered something on a music video, which would have been for 3 weeks, and they wanted me to do that instead of finishing my degree.
Your
and
degree.
I was like, well, I'm going to finish my degree, and I feel like that was the right choice long term.
I think so.
Yeah.
Did you don't have to say who the band is if you don't want, but did they turn into
no. Well, yeah, it was an all right video.
It was an all right video. Yeah.
And I was already working on it for free. It was just, this would have been like 3 weeks work helping to finish it. And no, I went back to finish my degree.
Yeah.
That kind of
makes,
the right,
I think that makes sense.
Yeah. I think long term that was the right choice. But, and I can also see why someone would take that job, because it might lead to other work at that mm-hmm. company. And I never did end up working for that company again.
Yeah.
And that will be because I said no. But
yeah. I think what I was asking is, have you ever been the meanie to the intern, or does the experience mean that you catch yourself before you drop the C-bomb and throw
throw something against a wall?
I couldn't think what you would have. I was going to throw a tin of hair, because hair comes in tins.
Yeah. I try not to be too critical. There have definitely been
just give him a little dead arm. You'll learn. Chinese burn.
I try to explain as diplomatically as I can that there have been people that have complained about doing the boring stuff. They want to be like doing the more interesting job.
You've done the boring stuff.
Yeah. And I still do. And everyone does. It's not like you're asking them to do anything that you wouldn't be doing, but they don't imagine, maybe don't always imagine film jobs being as boring as they sometimes are.
Have you seen Hero Dreams of Sushi on Netflix?
Oh, no, I didn't watch it. I remember everyone raving about
really
it at
good.
The time.
It's really good. But there's a guy, so you know the egg you get on sushi, that mm-hmm. weird like slice of omelette?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
The guy, so in their main restaurant in Tokyo, mm-hmm. the guy who makes that, that's all he does.
Yeah.
For the 2 years. To get that perfect, 2 years, because it's not just egg, it's a mix, and it's cooked in a specific way, and
it needs to come out the same every time.
Identical every time. Yeah, and that's 2 years. Like, he ain't complaining, you know, because once he gets that 2 years, he gets to fill the soya sauce
bottles. Exactly,
I don't know what the next step up is, but, like, if you want to... there's that phrase, it takes like 10,000 hours to become a master of anything.
Yeah.
Well, that's part of your course to mastery.
And it's not even, well, I had to do this, so they have to do this. It's, I still have to do this. I'm still, you know,
I'm
making
doing
hands
too.
And eyeballs. And
is that the like entry
cutting
level?
Out the paper pupils that go onto small scale eyes.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah,
tiny,
like maybe 3 or 4 mil across.
Is there a tool for that?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, it's a sharpened bit of round brass that you hammer.
You
hammer them out of paper sheets. At least in that particular process of eye making, like there was more than one. I think the larger scale eyes.
I was thinking like a hypodermic would work, but they wouldn't because they're pointed.
You can get flat ones.
You can get flat hypodermics.
Yeah, but no, that's too small.
Why do you need these needles, madam? Well, I'm an animator.
We actually use a lot of needles for things like filling holes in silicon or like tears and repairs and stuff. If you need like a tiny amount, you use the syringes quite a bit, but sometimes the needle is needed to inject a little bit of silicon, like just under the skin. So yeah, you have a lot. There's weirdly a lot of medical equipment that we use. We use the gloves and the needles and sometimes dental tools for sculpting. Yeah.
I think that covers everything. It's an hour and 20 minutes. We nailed it. But there's one other question that is just interesting to me because I've never really been in that situation. Your partner is a creative too. You're both creatives.
Yeah.
You both work in very time-consuming creative jobs. So you're both on like long-term projects a lot of the time when you're doing things.
Yeah.
Like neither of you work in nimble industries.
Things don't happen quickly.
Things don't happen quickly.
Yeah.
But like, how is it for you? Does it help? Like,
well, I mean, there's definitely a certain amount of understanding there. Like, and this probably isn't healthy, in that if he needs to work late into the evening, I've definitely got things I can be working on.
Yeah.
So we'll maybe spend an evening both working, which, maybe not the healthiest way of doing things, because I think we probably work longer hours than we should.
But I suppose there's, to a certain extent, you're enjoying it as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not like...
Yeah, I wouldn't do it if I didn't
crunch,
enjoy it.
Because you're not being forced to do it.
It's
like,
not crunch,
it's
yeah.
It's a choice.
And I know he's very careful with his team that they don't do crunch, but he works long hours because he's a workaholic. And I'm kind of the same in that respect. I find actually more that whatever job I'm doing at the time shapes how we spend our time. So if I'm working on a film and I'm doing 12-hour days, I come home and I don't really want to do anything in the evening. I just want to watch TV and hang out. And that's great because it stops him from working in the evening. But if I'm working on something where I've got shorter hours, I'll come home and I'll make something.
You'll want to make your toy.
Yeah, I think our time is oddly quite shaped by what I'm doing. Or if I'm out of work, then I'm like, hey, let's go see a film today. You're not working today. he doesn't really appreciate that so much.
Obviously his discipline is digital, yours analog as such.
Uh-huh.
I know that's technically the right term, but because in my head, digital and analog are very specific things about
synthesis.
Yeah,
I mean, it's analog in the build and the animator skill, but it's digital in that it's shot digitally. It's the program that most studios I work at now uses Dragon Frame.
Yeah, I don't know what that is, but I'm just going to do the thing.
Dragon.
Oh, yeah, okay.
It's got a little dragon head logo. Yeah, it's nice. Cute. I think they've been going for about 10 years now, and they're pretty good. That's the animation software.
Yeah.
So that's what's recorded on. And then after that, it's entirely digital. You know, you've got the post-processing and cleanup and any CG that needs to go in there, because there's generally there's an element of CG like, I'd say all stop motion at this point. And then audio mixing and all of that. So it's you know, it's still a lot of digital, but not my end.
Yeah, because...
I don't have anything to do with that.
That's the thing that people forget, like, that every sound you hear didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that voice
None
has to
it.
Be put in.
Yeah.
Every single sound effect has to be there.
There's absolutely, no diegetic sound.
Yeah.
At all.
It's a crazy level of that's the thing about video game work. People forget that everything had to be created.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one thing that someone didn't have to make a decision about, and that's the same for stop motion. In a movie, yes, it's planned out and all this, but on the day, how that actor moves or something,
mm-hmm.
is still out of control.
Well, that makes it, I think, more complicated, because then they've got to compensate for sounds that they weren't expecting, things they don't want to be in there.
But it's that thing of, like, we talk a lot about art being this thing you do in the moment, and this passion and all. The tumultuous human emotion. And it could be argued that because of the precision required to do your job, to do everything around you, like the entire project, that you can almost get a truer emotion, because so many people have thought this through, so many people have planned this, so many... there's been so many eyes and ears on it that...
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I'd say some of it is incredibly well planned. And then some of it's just a thing that happened on the day when you were shooting, you know, or a choice the animator made while they were animating. Maybe they didn't quite follow the animatic or the storyboard, or, you know, they...
An animatic's basically a moving storyboard.
It's a moving storyboard, yeah.
I've done advertising commissions, I've got folders full of advertising, full advert, you know, to write music to, and then get told that, no, we don't want this piece of music, and all that. It's like, cool, I'll keep this animatic, though, for the future, just in case.
I like animatics. I like seeing the sketchy version of a character.
I've got one for a... high-end motor vehicle company, and it is really, really strange when I saw the final advert, like how close they were. I understand that the animatic was there. In my mind, the animatic was to sell the idea to someone, not this is the thing. This is, like, to the second.
Shot for shot.
It has to be.
Well, yeah, it has to be. Definitely for stop motion, it has to be. You need to know how long that shot's going to be. You need to know where is that... Where's the camera going to be? Where's the puppet going to be standing?
Yeah.
Because you need to build the amount of set that you're going to see in that shot. And, you know, you need to... I mean... I was talking to someone about this the other day, about the difference between a storyboard artist who's used to working for stop motion and one who's used to working for, like, 2D animation or live action. They don't always appreciate, like, how much work has to go into rigging a puppet, which is something that's part of my job at the moment. So attaching... Well, I mean, there's different ways of rigging stuff, but basically attaching bits of metal so that things don't fall over, or so they can fly. Fly is one that happens quite a bit in clangers. Because it's in space.
Yeah, you're not just doing fishing line from the ceiling like people would have 40 years ago.
Although we do still do that as well.
We still do that.
Yeah. Fishing line definitely helps. But you've got to do it in such a way that you can hopefully hide as much of that rig as possible, so that the cleanup person spends less time like painting that out. And so the storyboard artists don't... If they've worked in stop motion, they understand that, and they'll angle it in a way that helps, or they'll think about it when they're drawing it, and
planning for
definitely. So that definitely in the storyboard process, but then also when you're setting up the shot, you need to be thinking about how it's going to be cleaned up, and maybe that means popping a green screen in, or shooting the characters on different passes, or sometimes it's just, oh shit, this rig's gonna cross that character, so you need to, like, take that puppet out of frame and take a clean frame without them in, and then put them back in again, and then keep going. So every frame you try. That's the one you try to avoid, because that's a pain in the ass.
You're alternating them.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
That one's more difficult to shoot. That's like a last resort kind of thing.
That's the.
Gonna take ages, but it's gonna help. The cleanup person.
Yeah. I think we're there. Now all I've got to do is edit this down to a listenable thing, get all the moments of me going, out, and we're done.
And
very few coughs today.
Yeah.
I know, I genuinely noticed, because the one I recorded in New York, I coughed constantly. I felt
like you've mastered the silent cough.
You would be surprised what these things pick up.
It still picks it up.
Yeah, sadly. Sadly.
It's maybe very... you have to cut out the odd bus going by as well.
I'll leave them in. And it's realism fun. And stuff.
We didn't get any pigeons.
We didn't. We didn't. They knew. They knew not to spoil it.
Yeah.
I'm going to press stop before we talk about pigeons for an hour. Hey. That was good, wasn't it? It was good. I was very rambly. I say this every single time, I think, but I felt super rambly that day. When I'm doing the long journeys up to Manchester and stuff, I think sometimes I need to give myself a little bit more time to relax before recording the pod. I usually just get there and drive straight in after sitting in my car for 4.5 hours thinking, you know? Thinking's not good for you. But yeah, Kerry's great. And like I said before, I learned a huge amount. It's actually really eye-opening to see just how much time goes into a movie like Isle of Dogs or just an episode of The Clangers or whatever. It's quite inspiring to see people go to that much effort when it could be done. You could still tell the stories being told through CGI. But there's definitely value to going that extra yard as such. I think that's the word, the phrase I'm looking for. But yeah, I really hope you enjoyed it. And don't forget to follow up Kerry on Instagram, @KezDyer, and check out our website, Kerry Makes Things. She put some new stuff in her shop just yesterday, I think. She told me that this is Saturday, so she's putting it in there Monday, but I'm talking to you like it's Tuesday, so... It might not be there, but I think it is. I have faith. Next episode's guest, is a writer, voice actor, radio presenter whose voice you will recognize if you have played certain video games we've talked about on this podcast before. And according to Andrea, is the best podcast yet. Not of all podcasts ever, obviously. She's not listened to them all. She doesn't have that much time. She's a very busy woman. But of the ones I've recorded. So get ready. Gird your loins for that. Don't forget to check out the Patreon. Patreon.com/DanLeSac. If you want to support the podcast, if you want to keep this podcast running. And... if you want some free music or you want to pay for some music, danlesac.bandcamp.com. Is that it? Is that everything I have to say? Who knows? Who knows? But thank you in advance for spreading the good word. Those retweets mean a lot. Those tweets mean a lot. Those Facebook posts mean a lot. Hitting up your mates on Friendster, it does so much, you know? Banging it in YouTube comments. I saw one of you post in a YouTube comment the other day and it really confused me because it was an unrelated video. But, you know what? It means a lot. Get on Bebo. Get on Friends Reunited. Get out there, you know? And I'll just end this here because I'm rambling. Talk to me on Twitter. Tell me to stop rambling and I'll... see you in a couple of weeks.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.